Okay, David, this is where we're supposed to choose a side, green or black.
John, my soul is as black as night. Your turn.
I am black for life.
So we're not fighting? I thought this is where HBO wanted us to like pick sides and fight and stuff.
Don't worry, I'm sure we'll find plenty to disagree about on the pod, but we seem to agree on one thing. We both really like this show.
The politics, the drama, the lore. It was made for the lorehounds.
And since we just finished recapping season one, we couldn't be more ready to defend our Black Queen in the Dance of the Dragons.
And with the season pass option in Supercast, listeners can get early ad-free access to each weekly scene-by-scene deep dive, plus our custom show guide with all the characters and connections. See you in the Lorehounds podcast feed each week for our Dragonfire hot, but probably positive, takes.
The Lorehounds House of the Dragon coverage is also safe for Team Green consumption. Side effects may include a deeper understanding of dragon lore, a hardened conflict with itself, and an inescapable urge to read the book Fire and Blood by George R.R. Martin. Dragon seeds may experience burning.
Hello, and welcome to Episode 8 of Rings and Rituals, Aloyd, from the Payne and McKay series Rings of Power. I'm Marilyn, the Librarian of Rivendell.
And I'm Sarah, Shield Maiden of Rohan, and we're delighted that you've joined us. Today, we'll be reviewing one last time what we mean by ritual, and then applying those concepts to the different examples of ritual that we find in this 8th and final episode of Season 1 of the TV series. We'll explore each ritual using a set of questions to reveal how Payne and McKay depicted the cultures that they were adapting to their series.
Be sure to get in touch with us. A discussion of two is an adventure, but we'd love to have more voices join us. You can email us at ringsandrituals@thelorehounds.com and or you can join our Rings and Rituals channel on the Lorehounds Discord. We'll include all that information in the show notes.
Now, listeners, please take note. This is our final episode of the series. Now, following this, we'll have a bonus episode on music and ritual in the Rings of Power with a special guest. And then we intend to have a feedback episode so that we can incorporate all the feedback that we can get from our final episodes into one exclusively feedback episode. Now, that means we must have your comments by July 9th, as we intend to record the feedback episode on July 10th. So start thinking about what you haven't yet said that you would like to say.
And we are also wanting to say that we are a proud affiliate of the Lorehounds Barovian Broadcasting Network, where you will find all sorts of interesting podcasts on TV, films, books, video games, and other stories. Our thanks to all the listeners who support the Lorehounds, and also Rings and Rituals, through good ratings on Apple iTunes, which boost our visibility, by joining the Lorehounds Patreon or Supercast, and from other forms of donation. If you like what we're doing here, consider giving them a boost as well. So before we get started, we just wanted to take note of the fact that at this time, we're already receiving bits of information about Season 2. For those of you who do not wish to be spoiled, I would suggest that you cut out now and come back in, 5-10 minutes or so. By that time, we should be talking about what ritual is and what are the questions we'll be using in our analysis of the final episode. Okay, time to leave now. So for those of you who are still here, we thought we'd discuss the fact that there's been a lot of conversation stirred up about the appearance of one Tom Bombadil with The Stranger.
Indeed.
This would be the first time that Tom has appeared in any visual representation or adaptation of Tolkien that we know of. There has been an audio-only example in the Brian Sibley production of the Bombadil chapters from The Lord of the Rings. You can find this on the CD called Tales from the Perilous Realm. It features Ian Hogg as Bombadil. And to my mind, he does an excellent job of voicing Tom. Of course, he's not acting Tom as well. Sarah, what are your thoughts about this unexpected appearance?
Intrigued, slightly concerned. I think intrigued because it will be interesting to see a physical representation, a visual representation of Bombadil on screen. And they've got a good actor to play him, that is for sure. Mm-hmm. But if they've just put Bombadil in because they just want to put Bombadil in, that won't be so great. I really would want them to be doing something very specific that mm-hmm. means that they need to have Bombadil in. I mean, the fact that they're transplanting him to Rune is a little bit odd. As we know, that was not exactly what Tom did. But, okay, I think I'm just going to leave it with intrigued, but waiting to see what it is they're going to do with him. And his boots had better be yellow.
Well, they were a bit yellowish in one of the
stills. Yellowish, yes.
Yeah, they were yellow adjacent, maybe we can say.
Yes.
Now, I do think that Tom spent a lot of time traveling around before he finally declared his kingdom to be along the Withywindle.
Yes, but as far east as Rune?
Well, he does say that, or I guess it's Elrond who says that he has different names for the dwarves and the elves and humans. So he's been around. Rune is part of my whole headcanon about where the Entwives went.
Mm.
And so I'm wondering if they're going to bring them in at some point. We did see that Entwife comforting their Ent child, their Enting, when the comet streaked across the sky there in that very first episode. So having dropped them in there so tantalizingly, I really do hope that they are planning to show us Ents at some point. And that could be a possible link. You know, maybe Tom had been keeping connections with them somehow, and suddenly everything went silent and he's out there trying to figure out why. I did also read or hear somewhere that the showrunners were wanting Tom to bring a little bit of light into what is supposed to be a very dark season. So take that for what it's worth. Mm-hmm. What I think about it, I can't really say at this point because I haven't seen it yet. You know,
right, exactly.
Let me get some material to form an opinion around and not just kind of emote about it at this point.
Yes. Yeah. Hence my, I'm intrigued.
Yeah.
But I'm waiting to see what they do with him.
Yeah.
And I'm also looking for a nice bright blue on that jacket.
Well, he would have probably needed to go to Bronwyn for that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, and, you know, additional spoiler, there will not be a Bronwyn.
Yes, I know. I'm terribly grieved about that. But, of course, the actor has her very good reasons for doing that.
Yes.
And I certainly affirm her right to do that. Not that it makes any difference what I think about it one way or the other. But she was my favorite character, you know, from the moment I saw the posters. Hers was the one that I really tracked in on. And saw the sickle and said, okay, agriculture, possibly an herbalist or a healer. And I was right. So, you know,
right.
Having accomplished that connection, I'm very, very sad to lose it. And I also am kind of sad to think, you know, what are all the stories that we won't hear because we lost that character? I mean, had they intended that she would die anyway? I didn't get that impression, but it's not outside the realm of possibility, I suppose.
True.
But true. There'll be plenty of plot lines that they can develop from that tragedy. So I expect that's what they're going to do.
Well, they've got four more seasons to develop those plot lines in.
Seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Any other tidbits you can think of that have dropped recently?
At the moment, I mean, I'll be honest, I haven't been paying an enormous amount of attention to what's coming up. I have seen initial photography of the new actor who's playing Adar. I'm glad they're continuing the character.
Yes.
But I thought that the first actor was absolutely brilliant at playing Adar. So it's
stunning.
Big boots to fill, or, you know, pixie boots, elfish boots, orc boots, whatever they actually are. But they are big boots to fill because he was excellent.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm glad that the character remains.
Yeah, and that's kind of an interesting contrast, isn't it, now that you mention it? There was something that they needed to have him there for.
Yes.
And so they replaced it. The fact that they didn't replace Bronwyn, I hope that doesn't mean that they thought that she was, you know, not essential. On the other hand, maybe they had planned for her to die, you know, early on, and they just decided, all right, we'll just start with this sooner. Who knows?
Yes, maybe.
Who knows?
I mean, I would imagine that they have set up a story, a clash of some kind to happen between Adar and Sauron.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, last we saw Sauron, he was heading home. Mm-hmm. And Adar is already there. So I'm actually quite looking forward to seeing what happens when Sauron knocks on the door of Mordor and says, "Hi, honey, I'm home."
Remember
see what
me?
Happens. Yeah.
And because they both asked each other, you know, who are you? And or do you remember me? And as I was reviewing the final episode of season one for this podcast, I heard the line that Sauron says to Galadriel, "I was fighting against your enemy and mine." So that made it pretty clear to me that, yeah, Sauron wants a reckoning.
Indeed. So I think there are some things to look forward to. I'm hoping that they've taken the two intervening years to consider some of the concerns of those who've been watching it. We'll see what they've done with that. See where they go with all of those storylines.
Yes.
And, I mean, I'm going to watch it. I want to see what they do. Whether we like it or not, that's a whole other conversation.
Isn't it just? Yeah, I'm also looking forward to it and curious, just really curious to see where they're going to go next.
Right.
So shall we go next ourselves?
Yes, indeed. And we'll start the way we usually start, because as our regular listeners know, we like to begin with a review of our definition of ritual, particularly for anyone who might be joining us for the first time. So Marilyn, what do we mean by ritual?
First and foremost, ritual is a repeated action, something that is done more than once and has attained some kind of meaning as a result of that. It's usually intended to recognize and or bring about change. It often has symbolic content, but not always. Walking the dog twice a day can be considered some form of ritual. How symbolic that is, I don't know. It much depends on how kind you are to your dog and how you feel about dog poo, I suppose. Ritual may be a form of meaning making, which does not have to be religious or spiritual. So we have fireworks designed to help celebrate, but it can be celebrating and recognizing a ritual of many different types inside, you know, the successful revolution or commencement night or any number of things. And ritual may create or reinforce communal identity, though there are also solitary or personal rituals. And I think that's something that we see the most in our exploration of the series. Often, a ritual gives structure and meaning to the unimaginable, and it may include humor, which can help one to bear the unbearable.
Right. So we'll keep those points in mind as we describe each ritual. And we're going to weave in the following questions as usual. What is the design of the ritual? What is the intent of the ritual? What is the outcome? And particularly, what does that ritual tell us about the culture and the individuals in that culture?
Mm-hmm. And as a special end-of-season treat, when we have covered the material from the episode, we'll have the great pleasure of listening to Sara take us through a discussion of alchemy in Tolkien's works, and in The Rings of Power in particular. Tolkien and alchemy is Sara's jam, and I'm really excited to hear what she has to say tonight.
Well, no pressure. I'll do my best just to bring a little bit of that to it. But we're going to take a quick break now. And when we come back, we'll bring you the meat or the tofu for our vegan and vegetarian listeners without the quail sauce.
Welcome back. We're going to explore the ritual elements that we saw in this eighth episode. But to aid our listeners' memories, we'll also include a synopsis of events. Though to save time, we may leave out one or two scenes or compile some out of order for the sake of continuity. Please note, we are doing full-on spoilers throughout these episodes. And if you really don't want that, then please go and binge the entire season and then come back and join us. The
you
stranger.
Want to start?
I absolutely want to start. The stranger makes his way into the greenwood with his star map wrapped around the apple that Nori gave him, a reminder that he is good. One of the Hissi sisters takes on Nori's form to entrap him, and all three of them, the ascetic, the nomad, and the borrower, kneel before him to honor him as Lord Sauron. They tell the stranger that they have been looking for him and that the veil covering his mind will soon lift. The ascetic tells him that the pattern of the stars he is looking for is called the Hermit's Hat, and that it is only visible from one place, Hrun. They tell him that he will have command over all the elements, and that all things will be his slaves. When he tries to tap into it, it is too much for him, and they put him into unconsciousness. Suddenly they sense that they are being watched, and they hide as the four Harfoots emerge. They try to lead off the sisters and release the stranger, only to discover that the borrower has taken on his form. A battle ensues, and Sadok is stabbed. The stranger emerges, and using the sister's staff, he calls upon the winds with his magia and defeats the three. From shadow you came, to shadow I bid you return. And they reply, he is not Sauron, he is the other, the Istar. He is, I am good. The Hissy sisters turn into moths and disperse. The three Harfoot women hug each other and then see that Sadok is mortally wounded. He tells them, I'm afraid I'm about to go off wandering off trail. Don't be sad, Proudfoot. The missus will be waiting. Now, if you don't mind, I'd just like to sit a while, watch the sun come up. He smiles at the stranger, who nods in return, and the four hobbits sit together as the sun rises, watched over by the stranger.
Right. Well, what do we think is going on there, Marilyn?
Well, of course, we have Sadok's death. And that's why I chose to read some of the things he said, because I find some very interesting details there. He conceives of death as wandering off trail.
Right.
And we go back to the ritual that they had for their harvest festival. And how they were constantly chanting, you know, nobody goes off trail and nobody walks alone. So here is the moment in any Harfoot's life when, like it or not, you are going to go wandering off trail. But his next words are, don't be sad. So for the Harfoots, evidently, death is not, or is not intended to be, something bad, evil, dark, scary, whatever. And most important, the missus will be waiting.
Right. Yeah. That fills in a lot of background on Sadok that we didn't know.
It sure does. It sure does. And it reinforces, I think, what we saw in that harvest ritual of not simply remembering your beloved dead, but saying, we wait for you. Well, guess what? The dead also wait for the living.
Right.
And I just think that's beautiful.
I think so too. And I think what we get here is we've had hints before this that there has been death among the Harfoots. Of course, we have that ritual, as you were talking about there, and Poppy's family, we know, are no longer there at all. But here we actually get to see a Harfoot facing death, and perhaps revealing a little bit about what the Harfoots think about death as part of his response. That death is, for them, it's all a part of the way in which they perceive the world and how they perceive their place in it. That the trail, if we're going to speak metaphorically, and why not? Let's speak metaphorically. That the trail is the path you take through life, and that trail might wind, but you have to stay on that trail. And leaving that trail, which during life is seen as perilous, leaving that trail only happens when you die. It's no wonder they think nobody goes off trail is dangerous if they feel that that's kind of part of the, that's the death part of the equation, right?
Right, right. And I also see in this a people who live very close to nature. They see the cycles, they see the rhythms. They recognize death as part of the wholeness, death as completion, and yet death as the beginning of something different. The missus will be waiting. Great. Then what? Maybe they anticipate, maybe they don't. But there is this sense of we are still with one another, whatever our situation or our circumstance, because we stick together.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody walks alone, wherever they walk.
Including in death.
Including in death. And the fact that they watch plants go through a cycle of, you know, sprouting, growth, decay, death, and then return, because they return to the same places every year, and the plants that were there last year are there again this year. So it's a very rich cycle, I think.
Mm. Yes, quite a healthy attitude to life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That life is cyclical and everything about it is natural. And although you should, you know, do things to try and prevent death happening, like not wandering off the trail, in the end, it's all good. It's fine. Sadduk's attitude to it, I think, is very accepting. And also it's quite sweet because the wife will be waiting for him.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see that, that's something that he truly thinks is going to be waiting for him, that, you know, truly will happen.
And there were some viewers who were wondering, well, there's the stranger. He's clearly recovered some of his powers. Why doesn't he heal Sadduk?
Mm.
And the way I interpret the glance between them, you know, Sadduk goes over and looks almost questioningly at the stranger, and the stranger nods. My canon is there's a conversation between them where Sadduk says, "Can you let me go, please?" And the stranger says, "If that's what you wish."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it brings up a whole lot of issues when you start having somebody bringing someone back from the brink of death through powers of some kind.
Mm.
That I think would be worrying to inject into the narrative at this point as well.
Yeah.
But also, Tolkien's world, Tolkien's narratives are all about loss. They're about death. They're about loss. We should be seeing death and loss in this story if they're trying to keep to the major themes.
Yes.
And nobody is immune to that, including the Harfoots. So I just think it actually is quite important that we see this happening.
I do too. And we see the four women sitting with him, relaxed, enjoying the sunset, crying.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, mourning your dead is an appropriate thing to do. Thank you, Nienna.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, it's part of life as much as is the sun coming up. And, you know, the thought of the stranger intervening in this process, as you said, you know, so close to death, it begins to have a little touch of necromancy in it. And that is Goetia. That, as we know from the texts, is actually one of the names of Sauron at one point. He's called the Necromancer, which means someone who raises people from the dead. So it just would not have seemed right to me if that had happened.
Right. Yeah, the kind of wound that Sadduk had, you're not coming back from that without some kind of otherworldly intervention. And I don't think that would have been a good thing at all.
No, it would have been contrary to nature, I think they would have said. Anything else for this?
Not from that section, I think.
This lovely section, okay.
But I do think it's an important moment. In which we learn even more about the Harfoots. And actually, of all of the people, I think the Harfoots have much more of a, no, not rigid, that's not the word I'm looking for, but more of a structured ritualization to their lives. And although we haven't seen birth yet, we've now seen death. And I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know if we'll see more of the structured aspects as the season progresses, but they do have a simple structure, but an essential structure, again, for their survival. They're living very close to the edge, and so having these guidelines, these structures, these rituals, is important for their survival as a community. And that was the other thing about this. I just got a very strong sense of community throughout. You know, he wasn't dying alone.
Right, because nobody walks alone.
Exactly. Even
on
death.
The final path.
even into death. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that was lovely.
Will you take us to the next section, please?
Yes, indeed. So we are with Galadriel and Halbrand, because after a non-stop six-day journey on horseback, they arrive at Eregion, where Celebrimbor and Elrond have been discussing their failure trying to use the Mithril to stave off the decline of the elves, and Halbrand is immediately sent to the elvish healers. So before I go any further, let's consider the question, elvish medicine, how do you think that works? Do they use rituals for healing, do you think? I mean, Halbrand is quite severely injured because they don't realize at the moment who Halbrand is, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The hindsight is always interesting.
Mm.
My first thought is clearly they have a very deep knowledge of medicinal plants and herbs and treatment. And I remember at first thinking, well, why do the elves become such great practitioners of medicine? Because they don't get sick. Where did this come from? Well, of course, you know, 1,000 years of war with Morgoth will tend to, you know, not only ruin your day, but possibly ruin your health as well. So presumably they began to learn out of necessity. It's interesting. We saw a lot of ritual around the return to Valinor. I'm not sure how much more overt ritual we have actually seen with the elves.
Not very much, actually, which, again, if we put that against what happens with the Harfoots, that's quite the contrast.
Yeah, yeah.
With the medicine, yeah, I mean, as you say, elves don't get sick, but over the millennia, they have come into very close contact with humans, and mm-hmm. humans certainly do. Mm-hmm. Elves have been around for long enough to understand the ways in which plant lore will work, you know, the natural remedies that can be used, and they will have also had to treat battle wounds and right. injuries and things right. like that. So whether it's ritualized or not, I don't know. I mean, I would say that the elves are probably about as advanced as anybody could be in healing mm-hmm. in Middle Earth. Mm-hmm. And whether that incorporates ritual, we haven't seen any of that at all.
No, no. And I'm asking myself, which of the Vala would I call upon in a healing context? I think Lorien is mentioned, but more about dreams and rest, that sort of healing. I don't think they really have a Vala that is dedicated to healing specifically. Listeners, write in and correct me if I'm wrong. Mm. Can you think of anything, Sarah?
No. I mean, we have Yavanna who tends to living things, but we don't really hear of her being a healer of those living things. We have Nienna who weeps for the pain of those living things, but we mm-hmm. don't hear of her being a healer of those living things.
Mm-hmm.
No, but I would love to hear from anybody who has ideas about that. That would be yeah. very interesting.
And Arondir mentions in an earlier episode that they have what he calls artificers
mm.
who are skilled in the arts of healing the body, but that elves tend to heal themselves from within. And that healing of the soul is as important to them as healing of the body. But of course, this is a human they think they're dealing with.
Right.
And so the approach might be quite different.
Yes. I mean, I have questions about the fact that Sauron, who is a Maia,
yes.
seems to have been severely injured. Has he? Has he really? Is he wanting to be taken into this stronghold? Is this actually part of his manipulation of what's going on? Yeah, it just seems unlikely to me that a Maia would be in such desperate need of healing. And yeah. also, he's obviously able to cloak himself such that when he goes to the healers, they don't figure out, hang on a minute, you're not human.
That was my first thought too, is like, whoa. What's he doing to disguise his real substance from them? Because, I mean, from the very beginning, I've had difficulty even before I knew who he actually was. There were lots of questions about, well, how did he get this wound? And why was he on the side of the road and nobody knew it? And so on and so on and so on. So many questions. But of course, if he is a martyr, then that's fairly easily answered. Although that also raises other questions of, well, if he is a martyr, then why does he allow this to happen and that to happen? And, you know, why does he stop trying to persuade Galadriel, jumping far ahead? Anyway, I'll ask some more of those questions when we get to that point.
Yes.
How'd you like to carry us on through the next section?
I will do that. Yep. So both Galadriel and Elrond are astonished to see one another in Eregion. Well, Elrond is going to be surprised, isn't he? Because the last he knew, Galadriel was on her way to Valinor. But Elrond does apologise for having collaborated to send Galadriel away to Valinor. And Galadriel explains that she leapt from the ship because she did not feel worthy of Valinor and knew that her task on Middle-earth was not complete. She says that she did not swim so far only to drown now, and she will not let Elrond drown either. And then we have this astonishingly mobile Halbrand, who, like, 30 seconds ago was at death's door and being hauled off to the healers, but he walks slowly into Celebrimbor's workshop.
Elvish medicine.
And he delights Celebrimbor with his appreciation of his fame. Yeah, Celebrimbor is not immune to flattery, is he?
Oh, it was such a good moment from the actor. He just nailed that. It was marvelous to see.
Yes, you could see him start to glow from the inside.
Yeah, it's just this transformation of everything.
He likes me. Yeah. But Halbrand then proceeds to tell him about such things as alloying metals to eke them out. Celebrimbor calls this an intriguing suggestion. Halbrand calls it a gift.
That was the moment, first viewing, when I said, oh, no.
That's when you knew absolutely, was it?
How could they, you know, I mean, they've been dropping hints all over the place, and I was doing my best to offer explanations for them, but this is the last episode, and at this point I said,
Our listeners who don't quite get that, explain why him saying it's a gift actually makes it quite clear he's Sauron.
Well, we may see some of this in the upcoming season two, but in the text, there was a being called Annatar who said he came from the Valar to aid Celebrimbor in his forging of Rings of Power. And Annatar is translated as Lord of Gifts.
So at that point, it was pretty clear, wasn't it?
It was definitely a keyword. It was definitely a flash.
Yeah. I mean, I remember watching that and feeling, yes, that's it. It's definite. But I have been suspicious of Aquagorn for quite some time.
I kept trying to come up with reasons for it. Well, he was very close to Sauron, and that's where he picked up this notion of, you know, if you want to defeat your enemy, find out what they fear, and then show them how to overcome it. I said, okay, that's level five. I hope he was in the shadows watching Sauron do this. Cognitive bias, it's amazing. It's a really strong thing. Yeah, it's always important to know what it is that's actually operating inside one's head.
Very true. Okay, so I'll continue with what happens next, because we head off to Numenor. And we're at the bedside of a dying Tar Palantir, where Pharazôn set several artists to sketching the king in preparation for a magnificent tomb. Eärien is one of the lucky apprentices chosen to compete in this task, and during her sketching, the king regains consciousness, mistakes her for Miriel, and tells her that if the island does not return to the old ways, it will fall. He commands her to go and look in the Palantir, though not for too long, because he did so and now cannot separate what was from what is, or what was from what will be. She goes to the Palantir and removes the cover.
And the scene ends.
Bum, bum, bum. So do we assume that she has the same vision that Miriel has seen, that Galadriel has seen in the Palantir?
I don't know what they're doing with Palantiri here at this point, Sara. I mean, there's so many unanswered questions. There's, you know, six others to be accounted for, and I'm guessing that a lot of them are off in the west of the island with the faithful. It's gotten stuck on Channel Big Wave, so I'm not sure. I mean, Eärin doesn't even know what she's looking at, so in that sense, how could it show her anything other than, you know, the drowning of Numenor? I was interested to have him talk about what caused his incapacitation was looking too long into the Palantir. That sort of has echoes of Denethor.
Mm.
You know, seeking more and more and farther and deeper until he was trapped. Now, of course, there was no Sauron at the other end to trap Tar Palantir at this point. They're clearly turning the Palantir into something other than what they were in the text.
Right.
Or adding on layers.
Yeah.
Perhaps
yeah. This
be
one
a better
seems
way
to be functioning
it.
As more of a crystal ball than...
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Which the Palantir were not.
No.
I mean,
no,
there
they
is
didn't bring visions.
No, there is one sentence somewhere that does imply that some sight into the future was possible, but it certainly isn't how we ever see it used. It's supposed to be communication between distances. And, you know, if a mountain gets in the way, then it doesn't work. I mean, it's kind of early cell phone more than crystal ball, I think.
Yeah. Because, I mean, Denethor, as you say, had Sauron on the other end of the line. And mm-hmm. that's why he was pulled into it, because mm-hmm. Sauron was able to communicate via the Palantir mm-hmm. the things he wanted Denethor to see. And to believe.
Yes.
So, I mean, in that sense, a Palantir can bring visions in that somebody can send that. It's a communication tool.
Right.
But if that is the case with this Palantir, who's sending the visions of the wave?
Well,
with what is it connected? With whom is it connected?
Right. Clearly not Sauron, because he's not at that point yet, and he's not at the other end of a Palantir. I mean, you could make a case for it being Eru himself trying to send warnings. I'm not sure that's the direction they're moving in, though. It doesn't feel quite right to me. But nobody else that I can think of, well, we don't know anybody else is at the other end of any Palantir at this point, except this one. So it's anybody's guess, I think, that, you know, having it be locked into this thing. And Miriel and describing her experience to Galadriel seemed to imply that it's been this way from the very first time she looked. Now, it didn't seem to disturb her mind the way it disturbed Tar Palantir's mind, but his explanation is, well, I did it too often. So presumably he would not let her look in it too often. And in fact, he mistakes her for Miriel, so perhaps he's reliving that memory right now and is trying to get her to see this is why I tried to turn us all back to, you know, the proper path. But it seems to have gone a bit awkward, shall we say. It's stuck on this line, and it's not going to let anybody else dial anything else, I guess.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, as you
say,
the curtain comes down very suddenly upon Eärin and the Palantir. I think we're meant to understand that Eärin has got some kind of part to play in what comes next for Numenor.
I would think so.
Yeah, I think so,
particularly
too.
When you start talking about building monuments and whatnot. Many people have speculated that she is going to be pulled into building a great vast temple for one Sauron who will be returning to Numenor and not looking much like a Southlander, I think.
Yeah, we'll see what happens with that and how soon that happens. But in the meantime, those Numenorean ships are heading towards harbour. And on board, the Queen, who of course was blinded in the previous episode, she practices mobility alone. Elendil compliments her, and she replies, "Patronize me again like that, Captain. I'll have your ship.
So
do not mess with Miriel." They each admit to one another that they are still of the faithful, even though the choices they have made have led to sorrow and loss. Miriel says that her father once told her that the way of the faithful is committing to pay the price, even if the cost cannot be known, and trusting that in the end it will be worth it. And they both commit to seeing it through to the end and paying the price, come what may. They go on deck, only to find the harbour filled with black banners of mourning for the king. Farazon stands before the body of the king, all but weeping. So here we actually do see, and I think this is a lovely contrast to the Harfoot's preparation for death or marking of death. Yes. We have the Numenorean version of this. Now, obviously, this is for a king. But Sadok, of course, was the leader in the Harfoot camp.
Yes, right? Yes. Good comparison, I think. Good analogy.
Yeah, yeah. So before the king is even dead, people pop along to do sketches for his tomb. I would find that singularly disconcerting if I was lying in that bed.
At least wait until he's not breathing anymore, folks. Come on.
Right. Yes. Awkward. Why are you here? I need to sketch you for your tomb, sire. Oh, lovely.
Unless it was, you know, 19th century France, and then they were doing death masks all the time while they were still living. Well, I guess the death masks, some of them were after they were bodies and so forth. But morbid preoccupation, anyone?
Yes, yes. So apart from these sketches, which seem to be something accepted as this is what we do, so it's part of this ritual of marking the death of a monarch. All the ships are hung with black banners. The harbour is filled with black banners. So it looks like they have that kind of way of marking death that, you know, black as the morning colour. The banners up everywhere, which would be a sign, a signal that everybody would understand. So it's part of the collective consciousness of the Numenoreans, if you like.
And please, my previous comment, don't let you hear that I'm casting shade on the French, because I didn't intend that.
No, not at all.
It is a fascinating part of a wonderful French cultural history. That these events come along in response to things like, you know, 100 years of war and so on and so forth. And each culture responds differently. And as you said, Sarah, it's interesting to set the Harfoots and the Numenoreans side by side in their responses to death. So clearly it's an event of special magnificence, shall we say, even though it's a death and not a birthday party. The tombs, I mean, this takes us back to the Egyptian influence, doesn't it?
It does.
Of Numenor and Numenoreans being obsessed with preservation of bodies as a means of possibly discovering how to revive a dead one sometime. You know, it's not just the commitment to honoring the dead, but also, gee, maybe we can learn more about how to extend our already extended lifespans, which admittedly have been shrinking.
They have significantly.
For the last couple hundred years or more, but not for any of the reasons that they think it is. I mean, that this is kind of the irony, that the more they try to extend their life, the more it is shrunk, because they are resisting the natural order of things. Whereas the Harfoots live within the natural order of things.
They embrace it.
They embrace it. They do not fear it because they're not trying to resist it.
Right. Yeah. The preparation for the tomb of the king just immediately brought me to Denethor. Obviously, many, many years later. And his preoccupation with the tombs of the dead, and this idea that in Minas Tirith they were always facing backwards, they were always looking to their past, and that is where their strength and their glory lies, and it sort of marks who they are. But as a result of always looking back and then failing to look forwards, we have a sterile city. One where there hasn't been a king in place for centuries, where you have a steward whose rule over Gondor just encourages that sense of sterility. Mm-hmm. Because, again, Rath Dynan is more important than anything yeah. else. The mm-hmm. marking of the tombs, the, you know, mm-hmm. The way in which memory is built into stone rather yeah. than used as experience to look forward. Does mm. that make sense?
Nicely put, nicely put. I think of Rath Dynan as the silent street and the comments on how silent Minas Tirith has become.
Yeah.
Now, of course, they sent the children away, but even so, there are fewer and fewer houses that are being inhabited now. It's one of the sadder aspects of Tolkien's beliefs and understandings that the past was always better and more glorious than the present, but the future doesn't look positive. Maybe briefly, but you know, he just had this notion of history as the long defeat, the great decline. And to me, that's really sad. It's interrupted by the return of the king, of course, Aragorn taking the throne and so on. But there still is this deeper sense, particularly among the elves, of course, that, yeah, this is beautiful and wonderful and it's temporary.
Right.
And looking at the way that Farazón is interacting with the king in his final days, at one point he says, you know, this is what we will all come to, even a powerful king, as if power would be something that could overcome death. And I think there's some seeds there.
Yes.
That we need to look for sprouting in the following seasons, that for whatever reason, he feels that one, quote unquote, should be able to overcome this one, quote unquote, should not have to suffer this indignity.
Hence the look of fear on his face.
Exactly. And the grief, because he's, I don't know who he's grieving for more, for Farazón or for himself.
Because I suspect
he's
for
the
himself.
Only one, he's the only one we see with a gray beard. You know, they're definitely working up his age. And I think that's intentional to, push him forward along this path mm-hmm. that he seems to be following.
So to come back to that comparison that we're making between the response of the Harfoots to death and the response of the Numenoreans to death, mm-hmm. I wonder if the very longevity of the Numenoreans actually makes death far more of an event, if you like, something to mark. With this, you know, this huge show of grief and mourning with all the black banners flying everywhere, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. because it isn't something that they are quite as used to in the same way that Harfoots are, we don't know what the lifespan of a Harfoot is, but yeah. it's going to be nowhere near the lifespan of a Numenorean.
No.
And therefore, death is much more common. That cycle is much more visible.
Yes.
Birth through life to death. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is part of the problem for the Numenoreans, is that they are terrified of that cycle. They don't want to even consider that cycle.
Yeah.
And the longer lived they are, the more death becomes this huge bogeyman at the mm-hmm. end of this long, long, long life. Whereas for the Harfoots, it's part of the natural cycle of things.
It's interesting when I think of Mediterranean climate, which I think is what we're supposed to be understanding Numenor to have. The seasons change, of course, but the differences are far less observable in many respects. It's much more subtle change over time. Now, somebody living in Greece could probably tell me otherwise. Nonetheless, I think that the Harfoots not only live with a more obvious seasonal cycle, but it dictates their lives. And so they can't not pay attention to that.
Mm.
And it walks with them and they walk with it. So yeah, if it doesn't become just one more part of your day in your life, you're going to have some neurotic Harfoots, I think.
Yes.
And, you know, I think Sadok, yes, as you say, Sadok was the leader. He was also somewhat kingly, and he does, to my mind, look a lot older than most of them, except for Malva and the sisters. So, yes, there are some Harfoots who do attain what appears to be, you know, a quite a nice age.
Yeah, some elders.
There's definitely elders there. And yet, jumping ahead to the end of this episode, Malva actually hands over the trail finding to Poppy because she displays an ability to read the maps. So there is respect of elders, but it's not a rule of elders in the end, I think one might say, or the elders are not absolute, maybe would be a way of putting it. One of the reasons I hope that they're elders is because they have wisdom. And so Malva has the wisdom to see when it's time to pass it along. And of course, Sadok's death brings that about too, because somebody's got to do the trail finding.
Yes.
And so if you got a bright youngster here who does appear to have a skill for it, and let us also say has accumulated some life experience, some very harsh life experience in a very short period of time. So probably does have a lot of wisdom, perhaps more than her age peers. So there's a number of things I think that combine in the Harfoot sense of leadership and dignity and the Numenorean sense of those things.
Mm. Yeah. And when your life is shorter and your life is harder and you confront dangers just as part of your daily life,
right,
you're going to grow up quicker.
True.
You're going to accrue wisdom and experience quicker. And you're going to be expected to act on that earlier.
Yes. Yes.
So look at the Numenoreans who are living until 200 plus still at this time.
Mm-hmm.
They obviously are going to have a totally different view of both life and death.
Yes.
Yes. Their lives, apart from these moments when they're at war, are not as dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to confront those kinds of dangers that stalk the Harfoots on a daily basis.
They also have an origin story of being special.
Yes.
And that really can cover. I mean, I think it's very important for every person to feel that they are special in some sense. Certainly they're unique, just like everybody else. But more than that, the specialness has to be sort of a foundation for security in oneself, perhaps, is a way of expressing it. But this is more. This is, we are the people of the star who were given this island and we earned it and we have a right to it. And you know, fair bit of entitlement, much, maybe, sort of. And look how incensed they are when an elf comes along and tries to tell them that it was a free gift given to them. Oh, no, 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 no. We earned it.
Yes, we earned this so-called gift.
And yeah. If you protest that hard, clearly a nerve has been touched.
Yes, indeed. Okay, so I think that's pretty much it for mm-hmm. that section.
Mm-hmm.
Are we ready to move on to the next section?
Yes, I will carry on with that.
Okay.
Gil-galad is highly skeptical of Celebrimbor's proposal to create a small, round, mithril object that will allow the power to build until it is all but unbounded. The High King has no wish to invest that much power into one person, even himself, calling it perilous. Galadriel responds that sometimes the perilous path is the only path, and such a path brought her there. Gil-galad responds that she should not be standing there at all, and that if this had been a solution, it was needed sooner. Celebrimbor says that he had been on the cusp of this for some time, but that Halbrand provided the idea of creating this object that would have power not of the flesh, but over flesh. Galadriel is highly concerned when she hears those words coming from Celebrimbor, because she last heard them from Adar when he was describing what Sauron himself had been seeking, a power of the unseen world. Galadriel asks Celebrimbor where he heard those words, and he cannot remember, nor does he think it's important, because the High King is set to disband the Forge. But Elrond asked the king to give them 3 months, simply because he is asking for it. The king says this is a false hope, nothing more, and Elrond responds with the king's own words, "Hope is never mere, not even when it is meager." And so the forge is restarted, with Halbrand at the heart of all the operations. Galadriel then asks a lore master to scour the catacombs for any information they may have on the bloodlines of the mortal kings of the Southlands, and insists that he tell no one of her request. Several weeks into the work, there's an explosion in the forges. The Mithril is refusing every effort to bond it with lesser ores. Elrond says that tapping into the powers between the seen and unseen worlds appears to soften the boundaries between the two. Celebrimbor thinks they've used all the pressure of the heavens and the earth, and it should have worked. Elrond counsels patience. Galadriel wonders if they've been pushing too hard, and Halbrand picks up on that idea, suggesting that they've been using too much force. Celebrimbor agrees, saying perhaps the metals should be drawn or coaxed together. The archivist comes with a scroll for Galadriel, and Halbrand watches as they depart.
So Galadriel is obviously feeling highly suspicious of Halbrand at this point.
I think she's rethinking some of her choices at this point, yes. Can I just put in a pin here and say that this is the first time that I've really been glad with this High King?
Mm-hmm.
And think, yes, this is a High King of whom the Harpers could sadly sing.
Yes.
That he says, I don't want that much power, and I think it's a dangerous thing. It's like, okay, thank you, sir.
Yes. So what we get to see here is this consideration of power that you just pointed out Gil-galad rejects because he rightly says it's far too much for one person to have. But what is this power? What would this power enable someone to do? And how does it relate to the unseen world? I mean, what are we understanding by the unseen world? Obviously, it raises red flags for Galadriel because she's heard about this before, right? But what is the unseen world? How are they in this particular adaptation? How are they distinguishing between a seen and an unseen world? Because I'm wondering what similarities it has to what we see in, or don't see, in actual text.
I see what you did there.
I know, right?
I've always had questions about what Tolkien himself meant by the seen and the unseen worlds. It seemed to me often he used it as a convenience to explain why elves who had been to Valinor after the death of their bodies and came back could be said to be in both worlds simultaneously. You know, well, what does that mean? I wonder if he even knew what he meant by it. I mean, it sounds cool and it makes a lot of sense and it, you know, creates a wonderful image and so on. This, just reading this aloud just now, brought my attention to what Elrond said more closely for the first time, that tapping into the powers seems to soften the boundaries between them. And now I'm thinking of the Ringwraiths.
Yes, as you should.
As they were slowly drawn into transgressing those boundaries. But they never do appear in both worlds simultaneously, right? They're in this world and they keep fading and they keep fading and they keep fading. Now, does that mean that they're entering the other world at the same time? I also have to step back a minute and say, what does this have to do with healing, preservation, and knowledge? Which were the functions of the three elven rings in the text. And I'm uncomfortable with having Halbrand be so closely connected with their making.
Which, of course, in book canon, he is not. That's part of the point.
Exactly. Exactly. So clearly the showrunners are having a different conception of this whole matter. And at this point, we're not given too many clues as to what they mean by this. I mean, I do remember when they were talking about the seen and unseen worlds and the power of not of flesh, but over flesh. that we saw scenes in the castle in the north and these orc bodies partly emerging from stone and all of them having clearly, you know, ghastly pain on their faces and so on and so on. So doesn't look pretty. It doesn't look particularly nice or preserving or whatever. Now, I can't picture Sauron being interested in any of those things. You know, his concern is power over flesh. Domination. That's his calling card. That's his middle name. That's his raison d'être. It's interesting they don't use that word at all at this point. Now, maybe they want to separate the three from the one, at least to that extent, for which I'm grateful. But we haven't, other than those scenes in the castle, I don't know that we've really seen anything else that would call up this idea of the unseen world. Valinor clearly is not the unseen world because you can see it. You can ride a boat to it if you are an elf or whatever. And maybe it refers to what happens to humans after they die. You know, is that their unseen world? But they haven't given us anything that would lead us to think that.
No, but I do feel, going along with everything you said there, Marilyn, I do feel that the showrunners have potentially a different view of what the unseen world is than even Tolkien did. And you're right, I don't think he really pinpointed exactly what the unseen world is for him. What we can tell is that the unseen world is where the Ringwraith truly belong, but that's because they've been made almost, well, they have been made kind of undead by the power of the One Ring over the Nine. And so they are held, if you like, in the unseen world, which is not a place where mortals are supposed to be. That when Glorfindel is seen by Frodo as this golden shining figure, it's because, according to Gandalf, that's what he looks like on the other side, meaning in the unseen world. Does that mean that because Glorfindel has been returned to Middle-earth, that he has had his Fëanor restored, if you like, that he has one foot in both worlds because he has experienced a death? Which is kind of interesting. In which case, Elrond is definitely, despite the fact that he's one of the oldest and wisest in Middle-earth, he can't enter the unseen world.
No.
So, I mean, he hasn't been back to Valinor, never mind actually had his Fëanor ripped from his body and then been restored.
He's never even been in Valinor.
No, that's what I just said. He's never been to Valinor, so he's definitely not that. So can Galadriel, because of course she comes from Valinor, but she has not experienced a physical death. And does that also mean that Sauron, can he? Because he's gone through all sorts of transformations over his time. We know that after the wave, he's so busy sitting there laughing at what he's caused that he gets caught in the wave and he is then ripped from his body and can no longer form a physical presence in the way that he has been able to do before. What does that really mean? I don't know what it really means, but I do know my personal thinking on this, and I know there are other scholars who think the same, is that the One Ring does not confer invisibility on you. Instead, it pulls you into the unseen world because that's where such unnatural power actually truly belongs. So your physical self is no longer visible to those who belong in the seeing and seen world. But you're not invisible in the way that we understand invisible. You are pulled into the unseen world, which is not where you belong, which is one of the reasons why those who wear the ring change physically, mentally.
Right.
I'm burbling, but you see what I mean?
Yeah. They start to fade.
Yes.
And but at the same time, they get stretched.
Yes, because they do not belong partly in one and partly in the other.
And I've always associated that stretching with the invisibility. That there's so little of your physical body remaining that it almost can't be seen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know Glorfindel was said to exist in both worlds at once, both Valinor and Middle-earth. And the Ringwraiths appear to be doing the same thing. And so in that sense, the Nine do have that function of preservation, which is kind of ironic. Mm. And then when you think about it, if the elves made the three rings for preservation, that was where they transgressed in the temptation. Because with whatever good intentions they had, preservation is not the mode of Middle-earth. Middle-earth is the place where things have lifespans, and to preserve beyond them is not something that you want to do. So I think we need more information, really.
Yes.
I just don't think we have enough at this point to understand how the showrunners are conceiving of this. But I hope we get more in season two, because this is a pretty central concept to the Rings of Power. So
right.
let's hope.
It's supposed to be a central concept to the entire series.
Exactly. Exactly. And then this strikes me. I mean, the elves are supposed to be doing magia. That's supposed to be their thing, which is based in nature, in natural processes. They just don't seem to get that what their own natural process is. You know, that their bodies don't fade over the span of time that they seem to think they're going to, i.e. within months. So are they using their magia by making these rings, or is it more Goetia? It just seems to me, with all this talk of forcing and coaxing and melding and so forth, they're trying to impose their will over these materials, but over this process. And, you know, if it all rests with Celebrimbor's desire to make something of, quote, real power, close quote, the rings of this show are even more doomed than the rings in the text.
Mm.
So we shall see. And I just want to put in a little commercial here to say, let's hear it for the power of libraries and archives.
Oh, yes.
Because Galadriel is about to discover something that she is not happy about. Would you like to tell us what that is?
I would love to. Because the last we saw her, she was handed a scroll. And she goes off to have a look at that scroll, and having done so, she is astonished to discover that the line of kings was broken a long time ago. Now, of course, this is linked to her understanding. Maybe she's just told herself this is it, that Halbrand is the lost king of the Southlands, but the line of kings was gone a long time ago. But Halbrand comes after her, and Galadriel confronts him with the absence of a line of kings in the Southlands. And Halbrand confesses to his true identity in a very creepy scene in which he admits, I have been awake since before the breaking of the first silence. In that time, I have had many names. And of course, one of them, although not one he would have called himself, is Sauron. Yes. Marilyn, why would he not have called himself Sauron?
I'm trying to remember what the translation is, and I don't. His name for himself was Mauron.
Yes.
Which is excellent.
Yes. He thought of himself as King Excellent, actually.
Yes. Yes.
That was
yes.
his preferred name.
So yes. Remind me what the translation of Sauron is.
Sauron is evil destroyer.
That's right.
That kind
yeah.
of thing.
Yeah.
Not what he would have chosen for himself at all.
AKA. The big bad.
The big bad, yes. So Galadriel, obviously not happy with this development, tries to stab him with Finrod's dagger, only to find herself seemingly back in Valinor. She thinks she's talking to Finrod, but it becomes clear to us that, and to her eventually, that Sauron, in fact, is in her brother Finrod's form and tries to convince her that his task is not to destroy Middle-earth, but to heal it. Now, that's actually interesting, Marilyn, isn't it? Because this has often been talked about in terms of the difference between Sauron and Melkor. Melkor just wanted to destroy everything and engender chaos, whereas Sauron wanted to rule over everything, but to make it and shape it in the way that he saw fit. So he didn't want to destroy everything. He wanted everything under his domain.
Under
his domination.
As they would say in D&D parlance, Morgoth is chaotic evil and Sauron could be considered lawful evil.
Lawful evil, yes, exactly right. So Galadriel realizes that this is only a trick. It's Sauron speaking in her mind. And all of these scenes that we get in this moment, they're all like visions, if you like, that she's pulled into by Sauron. Because the scene then shifts to that raft on the sea that we saw all the way back at the beginning of the season. And Sauron says he knew that if he was ever to be forgiven, he would have to heal everything that he had helped ruin. Now, again, for those who maybe haven't delved as deeply into the lore, there is, in fact, a time in which Sauron sought forgiveness, that he looked for redemption. Didn't last all that long. And of course, we know that he turned away from that path again anyway. But there was actually a time in which he was seeking redemption. Anyway, go on, Marilyn.
Just one note here. Notice the massive scale on which he is thinking. I'll have to heal everything I have ruined, as if you're going to bring back a bunch of lives. You know, you're going to do this, you're going to do that. So it, even in this repentance, you see this aggrandizement in a way, and not a shred of humility.
No, because he has the power to heal everything.
Nor is there any sense of remorse.
No.
And that's why I think he didn't, well, he didn't want to go back to Manwë and be judged and humiliated and put in jail and all those other things. But just this other thing, he wants to rule, he wants to order, he wants to structure and discipline to his view, which is another way of saying he wants to be God.
And yes.
That job is already taken, so.
Yeah, can't have it. So back to the scene, he reminds Galadriel that she was the one who told him to be free of whatever evil he had done. A nice bit of gaslighting there, of course. Thanks, Sauron. Galadriel says that that is not possible and that there is no future between the two of them, despite the shadowy image he shows her of the two of them ruling together. So a lot of this scene, actually, I thought was pretty clever. Galadriel rejects this because Sauron cannot see any difference between saving Middle-earth or ruling it. He just doesn't see that there is a difference. You know, he wants to save it for himself, not for the sake of saving Middle-earth, right?
The famous saying, be reasonable, do it my way.
Sauron asks what the elves will do to her when she tells them that Sauron lives because of her. Now, again, I mean, this seems like enormous manipulation to me because there absolutely no way that Sauron was going to be killed by some marauding invader who leaves him at the side of the road. This is no.
Utter nonsense.
Yes, this is all manipulation. And this manipulation has got him into Gil-galad's stronghold and allowed him to manipulate Celebrimbor. So if you're trying to tell me this wasn't all planned, then I don't
believe you. From before season one, episode one. And I'm also thinking back to Gil-galad's saying to Elrond that Galadriel's intense efforts to track down and eliminate Sauron could actually be the breath that's blowing the sparks that, you know, causes the fire. Now, maybe he came up with this notion independently, or maybe he didn't. It might even have been dropped in his ear by some unknown figure because Sauron was wearing a different disguise at that point. I mean, I think we're going to have a lot of backstory about how this whole thing got set up. I hope we're going to have a lot of backstory about how this whole thing got set up in the very first episode of season two. Mm-hmm. And it is true. The one thing in all this morass of lies and so forth and half-truths, she did say to Halbrand to be free of whatever evil he had done. She wasn't saying it to Sauron. Mm-hmm. But in the moment, under the pressure of this dominating mind and this evil genius and all the rest of it, it's very hard to parse that out and say, no, actually, that's not true. I would never say that to you, Sauron. I may have said these words, but they were not being spoken to you. Mm-hmm. But at this point, how and when is she going to find the courage and the humility to say this to the elves? And he does have a point. What are they going to do when they start to learn all this?
Yeah, but she's the one who brought him in.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And this is a wonderful example of goetia that Sauron is using here, projecting these images, taking on different forms, all the things that we see happening here. Fortunately, Galadriel is sufficiently wise to be able to see through them and reject them, but it's pretty potent.
Yes. Yes, it is. I don't think there's anything ritualistic in scene, but it is such an interesting scene and well worth picking apart, actually.
Definitely.
Anyway.
Definitely. I'm glad we did.
Okay. Do you want to do the next section?
I certainly will. Galadriel is plunged into the water, tied to the mast. Suddenly she hears Elrond's voice calling her name. He pulls her from the river Glanduin, and, after convincing her that he really is Elrond, Galadriel rushes to the workshop, with Elrond following her, demanding to know what has happened. In the workshop, Elrond asks where Halbrand is, and Galadriel says that he has gone, and she doubts that he will return, but if he does return, no one should treat with him again. Elrond demands to know what has happened by the stream, and Galadriel alludes to his promise to trust her whatever happens. Elrond says that she's making it hard to keep the promise, and she replies, were it easy, it would not demand trust. Galadriel says they must make three rings, because one will always corrupt, and two will divide. Celebrimbor finishes, but with three there is balance. Celebrimbor tells Galadriel that he requires high-quality gold and silver from Valinor. So she must sacrifice her brother's dagger, and he reminds her that true creation requires sacrifice.
So Gil-galad doesn't have any nice gold and silver from Valinor lying around?
Evidently not.
Okay.
And besides, you know, plot spoiler, right?
Yes. Yeah, indeed.
I mean, it's a huge moment because she is giving up that link, that tangible link. But I think it's also a version of what Elrond urged her to do in the first episode, which is to put down your sword.
Right.
At least I hope. She's already given away the actual sword.
Yes, Theo has it.
So maybe this is the final step in that process of transformation.
Mm-hmm. Now, before we go any further, I know you've got some interesting thoughts about this conversation about how one will corrupt, two will divide, but three provides balance. So go on, Marilyn, tell us about that.
Yeah, I question, is there balance in threes? I mean, I know three is an important number, particularly in the Celtic traditions, although, of course, we see it growing over into Christian tradition and many others as well. But it usually indicates motion. I'm thinking particularly in the context of interpreting of tarot, for instance, which, again, rests in a lot of very ancient systems. On the other hand, while we usually think of balance as being something stationary, that word balance actually comes from the same root as the word ballet, to dance or to move. And so it seems to imply that motion is actually required to maintain balance. Mm-hmm. And to many of us, that might seem contradictory. personally, I still think 4 would be more stable, but I think in terms of why it was 3, Tolkien certainly is strongly influenced by the Celtic mythology and other things of that nature. So, you know, I think of the elves as flowing and of the humans as stability. And so there you would get your 3 and your 4, except again, the humans got 9 in the end, but that's another number that we can talk about later if it ever comes up.
Yeah, and it might well do, because this is called the Rings of Power.
Yeah. I think we're going to see a few more ring creations before all is said and done.
Yes, I think so too.
So do you want to take us back to the Harfoots?
Oh, yes, please. Okay. So Nori and the stranger sit by the tree that he healed in a previous episode. He realizes that he has to go to Hrun now to recover more power and understanding. He explains that Istar means wizard or wise one in Nori's tongue and says, "Betimes our paths are laid before us by powers greater than our own. In those moments, it's our task to make our feet go where our hearts wish not to tread, no matter the perils awaiting us along the way." And that's a reflection of Galadriel's words to Theo in the episode The Eye. Mm-hmm. We've noticed a number of times, haven't we, how we get this mirroring of moments and words and things like that.
Yeah.
And this is another example of that happening. Obviously, the stranger has gained an ability to communicate very well at this point.
Well, if you're going to pick up something from a sudden awakening to your power, communication and speech is probably the good first step, right?
I would say so, yes. And then goes on to say, "Alone, it's just a journey. Now adventures, they must be shared." Nori says she thinks she's had about as much adventure as any Harfoot could ever hope for, and she turns to join her community. The Harfoots prepare to take up the trail again, and Malva decides that Poppy should be the trail finder since she can read the map so well. Of course, they have to have a new trail finder because Sadok is no longer there.
Even with Malva, the book in hand,
yeah,
someone needs to interpret it.
Absolutely. Malva says she wishes that Sadok was still with them, and her sister says he is, which I think that illuminates everything we were talking about in that death scene.
I agree.
Nori finds that her family have packed her traveling sack, and they help her to realize that she really does need to go with the stranger. They say, "You're a part of something bigger now." They bid her farewell, and Poppy makes sure that she has all that she needs before she goes. Largo fears that he hasn't taught his daughter anything, but Nori reassures him, and they share a symbolic series of gestures of farewell. Marigold tells her to find where the river runs and where the sparrows learn their songs. The family shares a group hug, and Poppy returns for a real last farewell with Nori. Nori and the stranger go off following their noses, and the Harfoots follow their usual trail. So we have a ritual farewell.
Yes, it's really interesting to me because it was clearly intentional and formulaic. They're facing one another, and each takes the other's ear in their right hand, and they touch their foreheads together. They then touch their right hands each to their own hearts, clasp their right hands together between them, and then touch their foreheads together again with the clasped hands between them.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Clearly an understood ritual, part of the community consciousness, something that they've had passed down to them. But I have a bit of a problem here. I have a question. Mm-hmm. How and why did they develop this very elaborate ritual if nobody is supposed to go off trail and nobody walks alone? Why would they have a farewell ritual?
Hello.
Yeah.
And it's not something that I can see them doing when someone's on their deathbed if they have that opportunity. They certainly weren't doing it with Sadok.
Right.
They just sat and watched the sunrise. I have no answers for you, Sara. I really don't know. But as I was writing it down, it just struck me. Where did this come from? I mean, is it just a Brandyfoot thing? Did they develop? And if so, I guess maybe there have been a few Brandyfoots that have wandered off trail before. I mean, it's a big puzzle. I mean, it's a beautiful moment.
Mm-hmm.
you know, a farewell embodied in gestures and very loving and close and intimate gestures. But good golly, Ms. Molly, when did you practice it?
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Who told you what the gestures were? Oh, was it written down in a book somewhere? Did you see somebody else do it?
Yes, it does. Yeah, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I think it might have been more interesting in some ways if Nori had gone to say goodbye to her father and they sort of looked at each other and said, well, we don't know how to do this.
Yeah, that would have been interesting because usually the going off trail is not intentional. Maybe. I mean, maybe there is some more to the Harfoot Pass that we haven't heard about yet. And because of that, they developed this code of nobody goes off trail and nobody walks alone. But they haven't forgotten this other piece. Right. I don't know. It's just really fascinating. I don't know much about the history of the development of, you know, special handshakes and other kinds of things, but I do have the sense that they're designed to distinguish you from the rest of the group or whatever. But I don't know that the Brandyfoots care to distinguish themselves particularly. In fact, the whole episode, they've been trying to show, yes, we're part of you. Don't leave us behind.
Yeah.
I don't know. Listeners, write in. Yes. What are your suggestions? What
We'd
are your ideas?
We'd love to hear your thoughts. Okay, we have the last section then, Marilyn. Take it away.
Yes. Galadriel yields up her dagger to the forge, and Elrond yields up his piece of Mithril. Which, by the way, is also a huge sacrifice because it's potentially his last link to his friend and his friendship with Durin.
Yes, it is.
The resulting pool forms something that looks remarkably like a red eye with a slit pupil. The elven smiths begin their crafting. Elrond goes back to the river and discovers the scroll with the Southlander list of kings. He returns in time to see the three elven rings, their creation accomplished. But Galadriel sees that he has found the scroll and turns away from his gaze. Celebrimbor has eyes for nothing but the rings. Their image morphs into the iris of Sauron's eye as he stands all in black on the border of Mordor.
Mm-hmm. Dun, dun, dun.
And the eerie song begins.
Yes. Yeah. So... The eye with the slit pupil. I mean, there's all kinds of Sauron imagery being drawn on. And of course, real callback to Jackson's imagery of Sauron.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I didn't actually recognize it until I started writing the synopsis. And I said, oh, there's an eye. There's an eye. Okay. Three eyes. Look at that. And three rings have been created.
Yes.
So... having just recently been exposed to some wonderful ideas about alchemy, what would you say, as a brief sort of overview here, what are the alchemical aspects or images that might appear in this whole process of the forging and the creation of the rings?
Okay, so I don't know how much the listeners know about alchemy, but... there are a few things that I could bring up just to give you a little bit of a alchemy 101, if you like. First of all, alchemy is all about transformation and change. It's about moving from one state to another. It's about moving from a base state, we think of lead, into the higher state, and we think there of gold. And that when we think of alchemists, we often think of people in laboratories desperately trying to turn a lump of lead into a nice shiny lump of gold. But in actual fact, that is not really what they were about. It's not really what they were doing. What they were doing was a very spiritual journey, which was turning the base self, the self that is in the world, and the world is full of bad things and ugliness, and you know you're absorbing all of that, but you want to achieve a higher state of being so that when you die your soul will actually ascend. All right. So the process of alchemy was, in the physical sense, about turning lead into gold, but in the spiritual sense, it was about turning the leaden state of the person into a wholeness, a oneness with an acceptance of everything about yourself and a rising above all of the bad stuff, if you like. So turning yourself from lead into gold, if you like. Now, with Tolkien, that I have written before on why the One Ring, I don't believe, is actually gold, because if gold is the product at the end of an alchemical process that signifies the success of that process and the purity of the end game, the, you know, the rising above, if you like, how can the One Ring be that? So if you want to read about that, it is available. It's in Malorn, so do go ahead and have a read if you're interested. But yeah, Marilyn's question here was about, do the elves use alchemy in the creation of the three rings? All right. I would say that they might be attempting something that we could point to as being like an alchemical process. Because in alchemy, the most important thing was about balance. So you had to balance everything. The hot must be balanced with the cold. The light and the dark must be balanced. All those ideas that we have about human nature, about the world around us, everything needs to be in balance, because if it isn't, then you are not going to achieve the purity of the end result, which of course was the Philosopher's Stone, which then produced the gold, which was the transmutation of the soul. Anyway, one of the conversations that the elves are having about the problem is that they cannot get a fusion of mithril with any of the other metals. It will not bind with them. It will not come together. And in alchemy, we called that solve et coagula, which is to break it down and then to bring it together. They can break down their metals, but they cannot bring them together. And the conversation is about how they're applying all of the power that they can and all of the pressure that they can. And of course, Galadriel then has the idea that maybe they're doing too much of that, because that's going to push it off balance. Right? You're not going to achieve balance by throwing everything at trying to make something happen. You have to look for where the balance is out. The coagula part is not going to be achieved if there's too much of one thing, not enough of another thing. And that includes how they're trying to make mithril actually bond with other metals. So it does actually have resonances of an alchemical process, because they're trying to take something that is, in this sense, more of a base metal and something else that is a more grand metal, if you like. But to make of all of that something that is extraordinary, that will enable them to heal the elves. Now, whatever we think about Mithraeum, is something separate to this conversation. But it looks like what they're trying to do is very similar to what the alchemists were trying to do, which was to introduce lots of different elements into the alembic, you know, the vessel in which all of this was taking place, and to actually bring them together. And from that bringing together, from that balancing of everything, would come a new element. And this new element was the important thing, the thing that would bring the transmutation of the soul. Here in this scene, it's about bringing all of these things together to produce that which will save the elves. So the fact that they finally do achieve it, we have to look at, well, what did they do to finally achieve it? And they adjusted the process. They tried to find the balance and finally succeeded in bringing things together to actually create these rings. So the process is interesting because we can see how they're trying to work through that. The end result, of course, looking at what they're doing here, because the showrunners have moved things around and we have the three rings of the elves made before all of the other rings.
Yeah.
Are they going to keep those three rings as the pure rings that they were in the books? Because they were untouched, unsullied by Sauron's hand. And so you could point to them as being the perfect end result of bringing together, because they've got to be bringing together, to make these rings, they have to be bringing together more than just metal. These rings are designed to preserve, to be part of the way in which the elves can be caretakers of the land around them. That's more than just, you know, one metal and another metal brought together. There's got to be something else that is actually within that, which if we then look at the One Ring, we can see the other end of that spectrum, because it isn't just gold. It is a bringing together. It's another alloy in that it's a bringing together of stuff, including Sauron's will.
Yeah.
And that is the corrupting factor that stops it from being pure gold. I don't know how helpful or useful any of this is.
No, that was excellent. Really very good. And I hope that that's given listeners a lot to think about and maybe even go back and rewatch that scene, because everywhere I look, I mean, even the shape of one of the pieces of equipment across the top, it looked like an alembic because there was a big circle in the middle and then this one sort of spout leading out that eventually poured the liquids into three separate channels. I didn't understand that whole process at all. Maybe listeners can write in and tell how they talked about it. But in particular, I'm thinking again back to that sentence from Elrond that tapping into the powers between the seen and the unseen worlds appeared to soften the boundaries between. Is that another alchemical joining that these rings are accomplishing, intended or otherwise?
A
because
balancing
of softening a boundary.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That implies maybe this is one of the things they're trying to do, is to bring it together in that fashion.
Right.
I mean, you know, from your class, I've already learned how extensively these concepts are spread throughout our cultures. I call it the non-corporeal cultural DNA of, you know, Egypt and the Fertile Crescent and Western Europe and so on and so on. So I would love to know just how much the showrunners were thinking of alchemy when they produced all this. Because I got to say, the forge didn't look like something elvish to me.
Mm.
It looked a lot more like almost a Rube Goldberg style, you know, steampunk sort of mechanical. And I couldn't really understand where the things were going and why they came up with one piece of metal at the end and then they split it into three. And then, you know, if you work so hard to put the three together, why do you then split it apart and make a mithril ring? You know, so there was just a lot there I didn't understand, but I'm not elvish, so.
And we'll neither are you Payne or McKay.
And no, I am not. I am not.
Well, I hope that gave the listeners something extra to think about. Like I said, if anyone's interested in any more on alchemy and reading Tolkien through alchemy, there's my paper in Malorn on the One Ring. But also, if you search for me in YouTube, there is actually a recorded lecture on alchemy and the Lord of the Rings. It's only about half an hour, and it's like a sort of a beginner's guide too. I don't want anybody out there thinking that I am some kind of expert on alchemy. I'm really not, but I have used the metaphor of alchemy to look at the ways in which it appears in literature and arts.
I think people don't realize how much it penetrated medieval culture. And since, of course, Tolkien was drawing heavily from medieval culture and in his world building, as we say now, I think it makes sense that once you have the vocabulary and the imagery, these things just sort of start to pop up everywhere you look.
Yes.
Well, that's great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
So that's it for this episode. Write in and let us know what you thought about this episode and of the show as a whole. Any thoughts about season 2 and anything else you'd like to share with us? We welcome your feedback by July 9th at ringsandrituals@thelorehounds.com or on the Lorehounds Discord server, where we have a special channel set up just for Rings and Rituals.
So on the Lorehounds website, there is also a contact form and a voicemail feature. Look for the Contact Us link at the bottom of the page. And we plan to publish a bonus episode on music and ritual with Marilyn and John Lorehound on July the 10th, and then our final feedback episode on July 24th.
Also, be sure to check out the other podcasts supported by the Barovian Broadcasting Network. We've got Radioactive Ramblings with Aaron and Chase, who are currently doing lore episodes on the series Fallout. We have the Properly Howard Movie Review with Steve and Anthony, and they're currently reviewing films of Felonies and Fugazis. Alista is now officially the third Lorehound, and she has her own Woolshift Dust affiliate program and all kinds of additional features. The most important one, perhaps, at the moment, because as of this recording, The Acolyte dropped today, is the Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast. There's lots of good information in there for all those who want to get the background on The Acolyte. And of course, John and David on the main Lorecast marker. And of course, John and David on the main Lorehounds podcast, currently reviewing season 1 of House of the Dragon in advance of season 2, doing Acolyte, and preparing for season 2 of The Rings of Power, along with a whole lot of other goodness. There's a link tree for all of these in the show notes below.
That's plenty for people to go and explore, right?
I would think so. It's a lot to keep up with, let me tell you.
I'm sure. So our thanks to our recording engineer and editor, Bob, to David and John, our producers, and to John for arranging our theme music, as well as all the others who support us along the way.
If you would like to support us and the podcast, please go rate and review us on your podcatcher of choice. Though I will say that Apple really does get the algorithm going in our favor. You can also find us on Supercast or on Patreon at patreon.com/thelorehounds. Subscribers will get access to ad-free versions of all the podcasts, as well as many other benefits. Until next time, then, remember, what's the good of living if we aren't living good?
Halvar. Farewell for now.
Nachgemin. Until we meet again.
Okay, David, this is where we're supposed to choose a side, green or black.
John, my soul is as black as night. Your turn.
I am black for life.
So we're not fighting? I thought this is where HBO wanted us to like pick sides and fight and stuff.
Don't worry, I'm sure we'll find plenty to disagree about on the pod, but we seem to agree on one thing. We both really like this show.
The politics, the drama, the lore. It was made for the Lorehounds.
And since we just finished recapping season 1, we couldn't be more ready to defend our Black Queen in the Dance of the Dragons.
And with the season pass option in Supercast, listeners can get early ad-free access to each weekly scene-by-scene deep dive, plus our custom show guide with all the characters and connections. See you in the Lorehounds podcast feed each week for our Dragonfire hot, but probably positive, takes.
The Lorehounds House of the Dragon coverage is also safe for Team Green consumption. Side effects may include a deeper understanding of dragon lore, a hardened conflict with itself, and an inescapable urge to read the book Fire and Blood by George R.R. Martin. Dragon seeds may experience burning.